Welcome to Dr. Hustle, the podcast where we interview physicians and health professionals who are living at the crossroads of innovation as leaders, entrepreneurs, and artists. Our mission is to showcase the insights and skills that can help you discover the creative and leadership potential within yourself. Here's your host, Bassam Zahid.
Hey listeners, my name is Bassam Zahid. Welcome to episode 12. Today's guest is an accomplished, multi-talented clinician that made me think a lot about the design of the buildings of where I work after our conversation. Dr. Diana Anderson is a healthcare architect and a board-certified internist. As a docitect, Dr. Anderson combines educational and professional experience in both medicine and architecture. She's worked on hospital design projects globally and is widely published in both architectural and medical journals, books, and the popular press. She's a frequent speaker about the impact of healthcare design on patient outcomes and staff satisfaction. And as the co-founder of the Clinicians for Design Group, she seeks to inspire clinicians to improve the design of their environments and systems. Listen to her ideas, and I'm sure you'll look at the place you work, the clinic or hospital, a little bit differently. I know I do. So Dr. Anderson, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So you've had a pretty interesting, diverse background. You are both a doctor and an architect. And you've mentioned this term hybrid clinician in some of your other work and interviews. How did you find this life path? How did you decide that you wanted to be a doctor, which is difficult in itself, as well as an architect, which is also a very challenging occupation?
You know, great question. I get the question a lot. I also get a common question of, did I sleep less in architecture school or in medical school and residency? And actually, that's a tough one. I'd have to say less sleep in architecture school.
Wow.
For sure. but lots of fun nights in the studio. Didn't seem fun at the time, but in retrospect, building models and trying to meet deadlines was actually something I really enjoyed. So hybrid clinician, you know, I don't think I necessarily decided on this career path, as most of us find we fall into things or people mention things along the way and we find ourselves going in certain directions and in retrospect realize everything kind of fell into place, but along the way it may feel more chaotic, like a winding road and you don't really have a path. But I do firmly think that things are meant to be and you kind of find your way as you go. And it's okay to take steps away from the path and do other things along the way. So I certainly didn't have a straight shot to get where I am today. I did a lot of meandering. You know, I have a slide that I show in my lectures to talk to professionals about this dual career, and it's certainly not a direct straight road. It's a lot of twists and turns down a mountainside, you know, lots of bumps and twists along the way. I started out in architecture school, and even then, you know, architecture is sort of in my family, lots of architects and engineers. It seemed like a great basic education, lots of experience in history and social science and art and engineering, but something, you know, something was missing. And I tell this story a lot, but during my undergraduate final year, we took a trip to Scandinavia and entered a TB sanatorium that's now a general hospital and world famous. And it was the first time in my life I walked into a healthcare space and didn't feel, you know, queasy, uneasy, whatever the word is. And I really wanted to understand why. It was very intriguing to walk into a hospital and feel comfortable, even feel pretty good, and feel like this is a space I want to be in and I would come back to. And that was a real turning point. And so I went on to do my master's thesis in a hospital design setting. I decided to learn, what does it take to build a hospital? Who's working in them? Who are the patients? How do flows go through hospitals? What department needs to be next to one another to be able to function? And designed this hospital for McGill University here in Montreal that was quite large at the time and was able to travel and interview at different hospitals and see how they were functioning. And then really got interested in the clinical side. I thought, I don't want to be doing the drawings for these buildings. I want to be at the bedside treating patients. This is what I'm meant to do. And I'm sure others out there have had the similar experience. You get into medical school, it all sounds great. And then you find yourself in your first year feeling stifled in a way from all the creative things you were doing before that led you into medical school. Definitely. Right? And thinking, you know, like we were talking about just before the podcast, do I give this up? How can I incorporate it into my medical training? Is it even possible? And I knew I could never give up architecture and healthcare design. And the more I went into medical school and then clerkship and then residency and worked in all these spaces and heard my colleagues talking, saw them practicing, I realized this space is a huge part of what we do. and you can't separate them, and I have to find a way to bring them together. And so I've gone back and forth between, you know, medical school, and then I took some time off to work as an architect and gain my licensure, then go back to residency, and then even between residency and fellowship, take time to work and understand more about healthcare design. So going back and forth, it's brought its challenges, but somehow I think I've created at least some sort of a hybrid model whereby clinical practice is very important, but also design consulting, being able to work with projects and take what you learn with patients into the project world. And, you know, I think the clinician researcher model, clinician educator model, those are solid models that we already have. Mm-hmm. So we have good models for that. I have to say, when I was a medical student, most of my colleagues I found were from the pure and applied sciences. And, you know, a number of years later, I find a lot of medical students have these amazing backgrounds where they've done anything and everything. You don't have to have gone through sciences mm-hmm. to even get to medical school. So I think we're going to start seeing a lot more hybrid models. At least I hope we will. I think it really enriches our careers as clinicians. And I think, you know, it adds a lot of innovation and diversity.
Was there any pushback you got from, you know, people around you for kind of bouncing back and forth? And then how did you deal with it?
Great question. I got a lot of pushback, mostly early on, saying you can't do it. You cannot be an architect and a physician. It's not possible. And if you do it, you won't be very good at either one. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I thought it was discouraging sometimes, and I really stopped to question it. But something in me was really passionate about both, and I really thought I needed to give it a try. And that the worst that could happen is, yeah, it's hard to balance, and you focus on one or the other. Or, you know, I have colleagues who've done two things and decided they wanted to focus more on one. And so for listeners out there, I'd also say it's okay if you have one career and then decide to make a switch and not do the hybrid model. You will bring what you had in your last experiences to your current ones, and that's okay too. Yeah. But definitely along the way, especially specifically residency and fellowship, a lot of concern with taking gap years, I guess we call them, or time mm-hmm. away. Is it possible to catch up? And sure, I'd say there's some, you know, rereading and restudying that you have to go through, but I think a lot of our medical knowledge is pretty solid. And with a bit of reading and reminding, it comes back. And so I definitely think it's possible to do other things. And, you know, probably some of your colleagues do a degree in public health or take mm-hmm. some time off and then reintegrate.
And this hybrid model for yourself, you called it the docutech model. And that's your combining doctor and architect. And you have a website, too, that we'll link in the show notes. So I'm curious how being an architect might inform the way you think in medicine, or vice versa. Do you ever use some skills, or do you think they use similar skills, or even, you know, are they divergent?
Yeah, great question. So the docutech model, you know, that's an invented word, of course, and went back and forth between archidoc, docutech. Is there an H? Do I get rid of the H? How do we spell the word? Uh-huh. So it's been challenging, but really, like you said, it illustrates this idea of a collaborative model where you can approach healthcare design from both medicine and architecture, both fields simultaneously, which to me was what I found was missing as I went through. There was this constant gap between the spaces we were given by others as clinicians and then we having to work in them. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about architecture and medicine, you asked if I bring any skills from one to the other and vice versa. I actually think architecture and medicine are quite similar in a lot of ways. And you know, designers, architects, and clinicians. And when I say clinicians, I kind of mean more broad, expanding beyond physician itself, nursing, PT, pharmacy, anyone who's really having direct patient care, trying to be more all-inclusive with the concept. But I think, you know, both of them draw on this idea of design thinking and using collaborative and care models to understand how things work. I think as architects, we're very in tune with users of the space. And as, you know, clinicians, we're also geared towards patients and their experience. I think I show a diagram in a lot of my lectures looking at architecture and medicine as two sort of longstanding, very historic professions that are sort of deeply rooted in history and kind of go along each other in parallel with a few points of intersection along history. So the tuberculosis sanatorium is one instance where we didn't have treatments for this lung disease that was affecting people, but we thought that fresh air helped and we found that it did. So how can we leverage that? And so we built these hospitals and architects built them to be, you know, treatment. And so the architecture was a form of treatment. And that to me is a place where the two fields intersect. But I think now I almost think that those two parallel lines are converging, and we're seeing this convergence of fields where architecture is moving much more to using science methodology and empirical data to inform our design decisions, which is something medicine has done for several decades, right? Thinking about evidence-based medicine. And then medicine, I think, is also moving more towards social science and understanding, you know, human behavior and determinants of health, which architecture has long done. So I think that, you know, they're almost quite similar in a way. And what we learn in each has a lot of overlap.
What do you see these days whenever you walk into a hospital? Is there anything that's like the most common, most frustrating thing? Like, why did they do this? You know, and is there like a common theme that you see like from space to space?
So, I mean, I think there's some commonalities. I should say that I've worked in a number of countries, so I am Canadian and seen how Canadian hospitals are built and how they operate. I've spent a lot of time in the U.S. and I had some time overseas in Australia to help propose a large hospital building there. And all those three countries, I think, do things in a little bit of a similar way, but there are differences. I would say the biggest trend that I see that I question a lot is the focus on public spaces and the front-facing side of the hospital. So, you know, in architecture, we have an expression called on-stage, off-stage, and we've taken that from Disney, whereby if you go to Disney World, you're not going to see the food trays and people carting supplies back and forth. They're all in tunnels underground, hidden away, because we don't want the public to see that. And I think we've done a similar thing in hospitals and with medicine by almost making staff and supplies and that whole side of how the hospital operates offstage. And we've put a lot of resources into the lobby. I'm sure you know, people, especially in the United States, can recount beautiful gardens and lobbies and dining areas for the patients. And then a lot of the staff areas and staff lounges are pretty, you know, bare boned. And so thinking about design equity for all users is something that I think we need to shift more towards and we don't have enough focus on.
Which brings me to another question. You mentioned design thinking, and part of it is often, you know, it's like a philosophy on how to best create for like an end user. Usually we think of patients as being the end user, and you're kind of offering that it might also be the clinicians themselves and the people who work in the hospital. So in your opinion, what do you think is the end user, or who is really the end user? Is it both, or is it the people who are there most of the time?
It's a great question, one that I've posed in a few recent papers. I don't know that I have a definite answer for you, but I think asking the question is a start. And I think until now, hospital design and healthcare design as a field has really focused on the patient experience, especially in the United States. We're a very consumer-driven market. Patients are our clients in a way, and the end users are really patients and maybe families and caregivers. I think we have to ask, what about the clinicians and the staff that work there and work there many, many hours and years? And then you could also say, well, what about the administrators and the sort of C-suite that is doing the capital planning and making the design decisions? Are we designing for them? And so there's a lot of different groups. I think if you think about architecture and some of the basic architectural principles of design, designing for all users of the space is really important. If you think about Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, famous architect, did a lot of amazing residential buildings. If you read about his work, he put as much attention into the bathrooms as he did the front foyer. You know, every space to him was important. It didn't matter who was using it, how small it was. And I think we have to take that same philosophy into hospitals. I do think we focus away from designing for clinicians. This is something I've been trying to promote. And there was an interesting op-ed in Canada last year where an ICU physician actually made the case that doing this offstage model and not designing for clinicians devalues our role as physicians. But by making us feel like we're not front-facing, we're not important. And that's really important to think about, because the design decisions we make as architects can affect users for a really long time. And so I think we need to be designing for everybody. And this idea of design equity is something we haven't really talked about and hasn't come into effect in healthcare design much. And I think that's where evidence-based design comes in, right? We need to be able, as architects and clinicians, to take these data points to the decision makers who are delving out the budget and making decisions and saying, if we design a certain way, this is what will happen. We will have better patient outcomes. We will have less staff burnout. We will have higher efficiency, happier users. We have data to show all of those points, but I think it's a matter of getting further acceptance in the overall healthcare community that design is really important.
And I mean, I feel like we are getting there, but what do you think will, I mean, because I love this idea of design, and it's almost even like a fun, colorful way to say, you know, we can be creative in this space also. Do you have any suggestions or ideas? Like, what do you think we can be doing to, like, other than continue to write about it and talk about it? And
so in order to enact real change, I think one thing that we have to do is real research around that. And I say that because there's a lot of debate about evidence-based design and research in healthcare design. And 1984 was really a pivotal year. A small study came out in Science where an environmental psychologist really pioneered healthcare design and started it out. But he did a simple thing, and he sort of said post-operative patients who'd had their gallbladders out were in different types of rooms. Half of the patients were in rooms with windows that had park views, and the other half looked at a brick wall. You're in New York, you know, the sort of New York view of looking at a wall. And how did patients do? And the study showed that patients went home sooner, so shorter length of stay equals cost savings, used less pain medication, and nurses were overall happier and had higher levels of satisfaction with the whole care experience. That's a small study, and I would argue it's never been reproduced at a bigger scale. You know, it was an N of 46, something small. But that really changed how we thought. And I think if we're going to enact even more change, it's about doing these studies, doing the research. And as architects, we can't do it alone. You know, we're not trained in critical review of manuscripts, in methodology, and how to read, even how to search. Mm-hmm. You know, I see a lot of medical journals now publishing studies that look at design in some way, but that's not accessible to the designers. So I think making those arguments, getting empirical data is going to be a way that we change. If we can show that design impacts how staff deliver care, clinicians deliver care, and even if it affects burnout rates, what have you, I think this will be very compelling. And we don't have that data right now.
I guess the challenge I also see in this is the idea that, let's say we're talking about physical space, the design of physical space, more so than like the design of like a medical tool, for example. These structures are usually built for like to last for decades. So if you're not thinking of it being either like adaptable or modular or in some way adjustable, I feel like that would be pretty hard if you can prove that this is not right. But then if that's the only space you have, you know, if it doesn't work as well or patients don't do as well.
You bring up a good point, and this is a challenge. So a big hospital building, especially new construction, that takes probably about a decade. You know, you have the capital planning. Sometimes you'll do a master plan and try to understand the current campus, but to design it, to do the drawings, to build it, it's multi-years, right? And we design these hospitals to last several decades, for sure. But I see your point. You know, everything in medicine and healthcare is so fast changing. How do we keep up? And I think that's where some of the newer technologies and design techniques could help. So something like virtual reality, let's say. Architects started with the advent of evidence-based design to build mock-ups, to sort of go into a parking lot, use some duct tape, kind of duct tape out the floor plan and have nurses and physicians come in and say, you know, if this room is next to this room, walk over, let's see how long it takes you. Oh, this room is too big, you're going to be inefficient, let's change it. That's also sort of a big cumbersome undertaking. What if we could almost pre-experience space, right? What if we could have people in spaces before they're built and save all that cost and time? Mm-hmm. And that's been tried in various architectural settings, but I think we can push the envelope a lot further. But I think technology would greatly assist us in that way.
Speaking of some more design, with COVID-19 and its pandemic, you know, is it like making your mind turn about how we could potentially redesign hospitals for, you know, to be able to adapt to a sudden pandemic or another kind of environmental crisis or any kind of like mass casualty crisis, for example, or where it is possible to readjust, you know, the flow through a hospital or the workings of a hospital by its space?
Yeah, so I think COVID-19 has made us all stop and really question current building guidelines and how we do things. I think we've always had in our minds emergency preparedness in many ways, but obviously not to the extent that we potentially needed during something like this, like a worldwide pandemic. I think hospitals and then the long-term care nursing home sector, sort of two different building types, but both hit hard. I think starting with nursing homes, having just finished a geriatric medicine fellowship, you know, this is something that I think has been close to my heart for a long time. And COVID has now pushed us to question whether congregate living is even the right approach, I think, for older adults. You know, let's take these, especially older buildings. A lot of them have no central cooling, no air conditioning, shared and even four-bedded rooms. In Canada especially, we have a lot of four-bedded rooms, shared bathrooms, communal dining, and that's just a recipe for disaster in the context of COVID. But nursing homes are no strangers to infectious outbreaks, right? They're constantly dealing with different viruses, C. difficile, you name it. And these buildings aren't necessarily supportive of that. So we're now trying to undertake big advisory councils and groups to try to get architects together, engineers, clinicians, and trying to figure out how can we redesign nursing homes. Mm-hmm. Some good models that we know of from Europe are the greenhouse model, where instead of doing a very long hallway with rooms on either side, with a big, big dining room at the entry, doing something like a neighborhood, smaller groups where you can section off and have, you know, a smaller kitchenette with maybe 6-8 rooms around, not having 32 beds share one kitchen, and sort of designing it more like a residential scale. Mm-hmm. And we know that model works pretty well. I guess the question is, do we force retrofit and force new construction? A lot of buildings are grandfathered in. For instance, in Canada, as I said, we have a number without even central air conditioning, and it's quite hot now. And people are saying, well, that's not right. But there's nothing to say you have to renovate. And so having done a bioethics fellowship last year, I've been thinking a lot about sort of bioethics and built space and what is our moral imperative as architects. Sure, we serve a client and we sort of have to do what the client wants, but we also are agents of social change, and I think mm-hmm. we're almost agents of public health too. And I think we have a responsibility to say, no, this building type or this building design is going to cause harm. We can't do it. We need to rethink it. And to think about hospitals, I think we're going to be thinking about every area of the hospital and how we can emergency convert it. So the big fancy lobbies that we're doing, open spaces, can these create surge capacity? And if so, do we provide for medical gases, for equipment that can be taken out? So I think we will start designing differently and change our guidelines. I think emergency preparedness will now be front and center, but I caution that also. I think it's risky to say, let's be reactionary, and now that COVID has hit, let's design with infection control as our primary mm-hmm. design driver. If we do that, buildings and nursing homes will become very clinical in context. And I've heard some nursing homes say, let's just make it more like a hospital. And that's not right, right? Nursing home is not a nursing hospital.
Right.
It's not supposed to be clinical. You're not supposed to have isolation rooms in that way and no blankets and anything soft. People live there. So I worry that we're going to be very reactionary. And I think we have to be more proactive and say, let's design for resilience. And resilience is like all encompassing. And through resilient buildings, we will gain emergency preparedness. And so that's a message that I think we're trying to propagate too, saying let's not just react and retrofit everything right. for COVID. We right. have to think about obviously natural disasters, other things too, but also quality of life, not mm-hmm. just of nursing home residents, but patients. And this whole idea of not allowing visitation has been something I've thought a lot about too. That's really hard. So now we have to think, how can we now retrofit and design for connectivity if we can't physically be present?
Right.
And we can't physically be with our loved ones. How can the building support some kind of interaction, either from afar, through, you know, digital connections, or could we design even solariums or ways that people could see each other and almost touch each other, but with a layer in between? Mm-hmm. But I think seeing someone has a great amount of meaning too, even if you can't physically touch them.
That just sounds like so much work. It just sounds so challenging. Like, I mean, especially if these are like, you know, 10-year-long projects, it just sounds kind of hard on how you can get all this. And like, it's almost impossible to ever please all the stakeholders.
See, now you're thinking like an architect. Yeah. That's exactly the challenge. You're given usually a program of every room and how big it is. and what the client wants and who are the users are. And it's like a puzzle. You really have to sort it out. It's not unlike a difficult diagnosis where a patient presents with really unknown symptoms and you have to be almost the detective and figure it out. I think these are challenging design problems for sure. And you may not necessarily be able to please everybody, but I think design allows for ways to balance people's needs differently from some of the ways we've done it in the past.
And on a more personal level, you've completed a geriatrics fellowship, right? Congratulations.
Thank you.
How, in your opinion, based on your experience caring for this population, if I had an elderly parent at home, or if any of our listeners have elderly parents at home, how would you advise redesigning that space or space at home that would, I mean, be safe?
Yeah, that's a good question, a common question. And I think as part of our sort of geriatric assessment, which is very comprehensive, we think a lot about the home environment. You know, many of the geriatric syndromes overlap a lot with the environment. You know, falls have often an external component, an environmental component. Delirium or acute confusion can be triggered by changes in the environment or over or under stimulation. Even dementia and behavioral disturbances and dementia can be triggered with the environment. So we counsel a lot. And there are great documents out there that people can access to say, how can you design a home? Some of the things I think that are important are, you know, just in general, thinking about my older adult population, keeping things consistent in the home. Obviously, routines are important, but a consistent environment. Day-night cycles are very important, and that's why in the hospital, as geriatricians, we're always going around in the daytime and opening everyone's curtains. We want them to get the daylight in and the darkness at night. These are important to maintain in the home. Paying attention to fall risk in the home in terms of carpeting or things people can trip on is very important. And I think the challenge with a lot of homes, especially in San Francisco, where I just lived for a year, are the stairs. Mm-hmm. And that can really isolate people. So how can you, with the current home, make sure that you foster some interaction and provide outdoor access? That's always really important, that I think needs to be accessible in nursing homes too. So we know outdoor access is important.
Do you mind if I ask, how did you find yourself interested in geriatrics as a specialty?
So I think it's a, you know, I think it's a patient population that I've always really been drawn to. I had a grandmother in my life who was very important to me and spent a lot of time with her. But also I think geriatrics is the one patient population and area of medicine that design can have a humongous impact in terms of prevention and even potentially treatment. And so for some of the syndromes I just mentioned, sort of fall prevention, delirium, dementia, we're starting to learn more about neuroarchitecture. So we're overlapping neuroscience and architecture and really realizing some of the areas of the brain that are impacted by, let's say, Alzheimer's disease or certain dementias are the same areas that we use for spatial navigation. And so this is why you hear about, you know, the dementia village in Europe or now Canada, and designing wandering paths, making sure the environment doesn't limit how the brain wants to function. And so it's really fascinating to me to think that we're now combining architecture and neuroscience together to try to promote that. Certainly delirium, and many of the listeners will know a lot about delirium. I have to say, in medical school, I'm not sure I knew a lot about it, but certainly in the last decade, we've published a lot. We know a lot about it. And no doubt there's a physical environment component, you know, the day-night cycle, noise. If you look at some of the sensory deprivation studies done in the 1970s, where you took healthy volunteers and sort of strapped them to a bed and said, you can't move, you can't do anything, maybe you can listen to a radio, you know, it took two and a half hours and people had sensory disturbances. And so this is really important. The environment can actually potentially prevent this from happening. That leads people to lots of morbidity and mortality, potentially even long term. So that really interested me, as does nursing home design and this idea of the dementia village. And so for those who aren't familiar, the dementia village really pioneered in the Netherlands, and really, like it sounds, a village concept where, you know, instead of kind of using the building as a restraint and containing people in it by either, you know, we do these trompe-l'oeil walls, this sort of false wall where, you know, there's a door, but we paint over it. And so the patient with dementia thinks it's a bookcase because that's what the painting is. But really, that's the way you exit the building. And so in a way, we're sort of using the building as a restraint. But the dementia village promotes permissive wandering and meaningful activity, right? You can leave your little apartment, you can go, there's a hair salon, there's a grocery store, you can do all these things. Technically, it's a gated community in a way, so you couldn't leave the perimeter. Mm-hmm. So there's some criticism about this idea of creating an illusion of a village. Is that even right? Is that ethically mm-hmm. right for us to trick people in a way? And I think, you know, some people have talked about pediatric hospitals using the distraction technique, right? There's lots of things to distract kids, and maybe that's okay because we're just distracting them and the parents know it isn't real. But the dementia village has been questioned. But anecdotal reports show that people who live there use much less psychotropic medication to control mm-hmm. any agitation, have a much higher quality of life potentially. But to my point about research, we have no empirical data. And so should this be the standard of care? I don't know that I, you know, it sounds good to me mm-hmm. from a design perspective, it makes sense, but that's why I think we really need to combine sort of design thinking with the data, with the clinical experience and the patient experience, and kind of get a fully all-encompassed design technique or process.
How big are these villages? Like, how many people live in them?
You know, they're not too large. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but I, you know, I would say probably not hundreds. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you could probably develop, if you wanted to do something with lots of residents or beds, you could technically break it down so you have smaller pods.
Right.
There are certain examples of critical care units where, you know, pod is a nice architectural term and we like right. to use it, but developing a pod of 4, 6, maybe 8 rooms that have their own sort of decentralized nursing area, decentralized supplies, and you can almost end up with smaller ICUs within a bigger one. And that could function pretty well too.
I mean, I feel like I guess it would be okay. I mean, I feel like that's a great idea, to be honest, because it's almost a space that they can live in and still feel independent while at the same time still being cared for. But I mean, I guess I understand the ethical part of it, but I mean, it sounds like it would give them, because then there's a question of, you know, depending on what stage of dementia they are, if they're really understanding where they are to begin with, and that if they even understand that they might be confined.
Right. So you're asking a lot of the questions mm-hmm. others are asking, and we've been trying to explore in some of the literature. I think for now, what I can tell you is anecdotally, we think that these work better. And it's interesting to think that people take less medication, and you can mm-hmm. use the environment as a tool in terms of preventing symptoms. So that really fascinates me.
And when you say, you know, to combine the analytics and the data, what would you be measuring? Do you think you would, like, let's say I was like, here's X amount of money so we can, like, set this up and design what, you know, the dream world, right? Like, we can design, you know, a dementia village and have residents stay there to see if this is viable or not. What would you want to measure? I mean, medications is one thing. Like, can you pull them off this polypharmacy approach of controlling their delirium, you know, but what else would you, do you think you'd want to measure?
Yeah. So that's, you're getting to the point of designing these studies to figure out how we can measure the impact of the built environment on health outcomes. And that's not an easy question. And along the way, people have said, well, you can't study these outcomes. You can't design a study. You could never design a randomized control trial, let's say, that compares to environments. Certainly there have been some very well done studies published in reputable journals that have looked at the physical environment. So for instance, looking at rates of falls in beds that are near a window or not near a window. Mm-hmm. And I think through proper study design and methodology, you can control for confounding variables. Certainly I've seen studies that will compare sort of you know, almost like the one I told you about with the windows with the brick wall and nature view, if you can find the proper setting, and then you're restricted to one site. So really, to make it more applicable, you probably would want a multi-site study. I think, you know, medication use would be something to measure. Rates of delirium has also been looked at in ICUs and windows. Mm-hmm. So I told you the 1984 study made a case for windows with nature views. There was a subsequent study that looked at ICUs and windows and found that it didn't decrease cost or length of stay or delirium. I think potentially you could ask, well, were patients' eyes even open? And you could mm-hmm. go even further and say, can you really study windows in someone who's sedated and ventilated? Does that even make sense? But certainly studies have asked, you know, certain questions. I think, you know, as long as it's sort of a limited targeted question, I think there are ways to possibly design it. I have no doubt there could be a way to study the dementia village and ask certain research questions.
What do you see the future of healthcare design to look like?
Yeah, so healthcare design, I mean, I think it touches on some stuff we've already talked about. I think, involving users is a big change I'd like to see in healthcare design. So involving clinicians in the design process and even in the pre-design phases is, I think, what we're going to see in the future. I think clinicians have started to stand up and say they want a say in the environments they're going to work in. And I would say when I started my career, you know, people said, this is crazy, it's not done. And then as I went through, and even now, every week, I would say I get several emails or calls from emerging professionals in one or the other field saying, I want to do both. I'm a physician and, you know, I operate in the OR, and I've noticed that if the OR is not designed right, I don't operate as efficiently. So I want to be able to participate. And so how can healthcare design change now from it being, you know, designers and the clients producing these buildings and then we as clinicians come in and work there to being more all-encompassing? And so that, I think, is the future, or should be the future, and hopefully is the future. And we're starting to get there. And then I think in emphasizing research, but I'll caveat that and say, I don't know that now we have to say to all architects, well, in school, you have to study research and be able to conduct a study and you have to be able to search the literature. I don't know that that's realistic. So I wonder if we even need to think about a separate field, you know, because research and clinical medicine are different entities too, right? You can do both, but you can also do one or the other. Should we not, maybe not put the onus just on architects, but do we need a whole other field maybe within research to look at the built environment? Is that something that is the way of the future? Certainly design equity is something, the focus on research, the changing design of nursing homes, and also guidelines, right? So minimum standard guidelines. We have a lot of great building codes and guidelines already. Even for certain units like intensive care units, we have design guidelines. But I think we have some areas that are still lacking. So especially geriatric environments. Some of the listeners may know about geriatric emergency departments. I think Mount Sinai in New York was one of the first ones that said we need a specialized environment to try to stave off delirium and prevent falls and support the older adult population. We don't have really any minimum standard guidelines. So any ER that potentially puts in acoustic tile in the ceiling or views to nature can say, well, we have a geriatric ER. Mm-hmm. And obviously the geriatric ER is about the physical environment, but also the care model. So you want to have the multidisciplinary team, family. So there's more than just the design. But, you know, should we be more rigorous? And should we say, no, to have a geriatric-friendly environment, you need at least, you know, these 10 items. And I'm of the camp that, yes, we probably should have that with good clinical evidence to back it. And then another thing, right? I just mentioned care models. You know, these care models are important because if we deliver you a space and your care model doesn't match up, so if we design a very nice, let's say, emergency, you work in the emergency department, and we put the CAT scanner, you know, 400 meters down the way and up two floors, that's not your model of care, right? You have to understand that when somebody comes in, you're going to need a CAT scan sooner. It's going to need to be in closer proximity. So that's where I think clinicians can provide such valuable info about how they work and the care model processes. And that has to overlap with design to be able to have a functioning building.
So I was like looking back at some of your work, and you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in like 2009, you published a study where you looked at ICUs that had won an award in design, ICU design. Ultimately, you looked at like 12 different ICUs, and you kind of looked at the characteristics that were in common in all these ICUs. And then I think it was like a couple of years later, you were part of a group that won the award for designing an ICU. Was that right?
Yeah, so that's sort of right. You've definitely done your homework and done some background research. So the Society for Critical Care Medicine, the SCCM, they have a really interesting design competition. And, you know, this is a clinical society, but they offer every year an award for ICU design. And that's co-sponsored by the American Academy of Critical Care Nurses and also the American Institute of Architects, Academy of Architecture for Health. So it's almost like critical care medicine, critical care nursing, and architecture have joined to say, let's get submissions. And, you know, the hospital submits. It's not the architect, okay? The hospital and the doctors will submit something, the clinical team, and there's a committee that judges it. Mm-hmm. And so I sit on that committee. I have chaired the committee in the past, and this is a longstanding competition. And we've really expanded to not just include American entries, but we've seen worldwide entries. and it's not just adult ICUs, it's pediatric, neonatal. I think it's a great event. And so we get this multidisciplinary team together in various cities around the country and even the world. We had one in Australia, one year in Canada, to sit around and we look at the floor plans. We look at a video that's made by the critical care unit. And then, you know, all of the clinicians in the room, the architects, the designers, we all sort of talk about it and judge these entries. It's a really rewarding, rich experience to be in that room. Mm-hmm. And then, yes, at one point, through a Tradewell fellowship year that I did at an architecture firm down in Houston, which was a fantastic year and really kickstarted the healthcare design career of mine, we decided to look at a lot of the winning entries and see if we could isolate or identify design trends. And that involved, you know, drawing out the floor plans by hand, really doing area takeoffs to understand the sizes and ratios of rooms to circulation, mm-hmm. And lots of very unique different floor plans. And you could maybe argue this isn't a very rigorous methodology, but I think something like that is a very useful tool to identify design trends. Like, for instance, we're all familiar with the centralized nursing station and then the idea of decentralized nursing, mm-hmm. right? That's really been a change. We didn't identify any units except one that was fully decentralized, basically saying there's only these little touchdown places around the ICU, but there's no central congregating area for staff. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at it, really the trend is to have probably a central space, but also decentralized as well. And so that's one example. Outdoor mm-hmm. space, we looked okay. at circulation. And you know, we've awarded international entries too. And it's very challenging to judge, you know, based on budget. And we do ask whether budget was a limiting factor, but we've awarded very sort of basic, simplistic ICUs that don't have all the bells and whistles, but we found were really efficient in their design and really didn't even go over budget. So it's not even about budget. And I want to make that very, very clear. Mm-hmm. It good design doesn't mean it's more expensive. And right. there's even data to show, you know, there was a famous published article about what we call the fable hospital, where we just made up a hospital and then the costs were done. How much would it cost to put in windows in every room, to have acoustic tile, to, you know, do all the good evidence-based design interventions to prevent medical error through better lighting, to prevent hospital-acquired infections through sink placement? Mm-hmm. Sure, it costed more upfront, but the return on investment was 2 to 3 years, which is really fast to gain back. And we don't even know length of stay and if we save on delirium costs. And there's, I think, a whole bunch of other hidden factors that wasn't incorporated into that paper, but right. You could think would add even more cost savings.
How does your creative process, like how do you get in the zone to like create?
It's a good question. What do you mean by create in terms of clinical creativity or architecture?
Yeah, either one. Whether you're deciding I want to write a piece, like I have this article I want to write, or do I want to, you know, sit down and, you know, design a space? How do you, you know, find the flow essentially?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, sketching as an architect's always been really important, and it doesn't have to be a really detailed drawing, but just even sort of sketching a layout or an outline for something. You know, I used to keep a notebook in my pocket as a medical resident and a few sketches in some of my lectures, you know, sketching different environments I would be in, or someone would tell me about a space and I would try to recreate that, or that was really important. And I think even now when I go back and look at even a very simple sketch, and you'll notice this with some, you know, very well-known architects who do these great, crazy sketches with three mm-hmm. lines, but you can almost imagine yourself in the space. I think to me, it takes me back there and I understand the emotion I felt at the time that inspired some of the ideas to then go on and write a piece or think about a different concept. And that said, writing too is also important. So words and how to overlay that with some of the architectural or sketchy concepts. When I started residency, a mentor gave me good advice and said, you know, you should write about your experiences. And many clinicians write. Mm-hmm. It can be very helpful, memoirs or, you know, other forms of writing, journalism. And I said, well, yes, but as an intern, I won't have time to write. And I won't be able to write these great diaries of all the patients I encounter every day. And the mentor said, it doesn't matter. It can be one word or one sentence. It doesn't have to be a full essay. And that really stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, writing things down, I kept a whole sort of logbook during my residency that might just be quotes I heard or words or pieces of memories. And that's really impactful when I go back and look at it. And then I think what inspires me are other people. Social media has been a great tool. And I, you know, I'm kind of a Twitter addict. which is a problem. I try to not spend so much time on there, but just seeing what other people are thinking and how can you take someone's idea, mix it with your own and come up with something really innovative, or even reach out. I love that people reach out on social media and say, hey, I've been thinking about this too. And you sort of realize, you know, it's not such a crazy idea and I'm not alone out there. And so that's been really great for a creative process too.
Speaking of creativity and innovation, I remember when I first started learning about design thinking and designing spaces for a creative thought or innovative thought, you know, it often involved, and that's also when I, you know, was first, you know, preparing for medical school and going through my pre-med life. I remember it was also the time of the big tech and startup innovation and boom, and you know, the idea of these guys and girls who are like working in like a small apartment and they're just cranking out code or whatever they're doing, but they're in a, you know, very close to each other. In this time of this like social distancing era, how do you design for innovation now when?
Right. And that's a question that we're starting to grapple with, because I think, you know, we had that open office concept for a long time. If you look at all of the architectural offices, most of them are this open plan to try to foster collaboration. I think we've realized, similar to how we do centralized versus decentralized nursing, going fully one way or fully the other isn't the right approach, right? There's downsides to each. So how do you come up with a blend? And certainly human interaction, I'm not sure I think can ever be replaced fully by, you know, virtual means. I always like to talk about this one statistic of the fact that 80% or more scientific discoveries happen outside the lab in these social settings. And I like to talk about the Salk Institute, designed by Louis Kahn in California, whereby the architect, you know, sure, designed the lab benches as he had to, but then drew the scientists out of the lab to these wonderful spaces outside, you know, San Diego weather, blackboards. And if you go around there, you'll see lots of different formulas and notes, and people have come out and thought together on their coffee break and then gone back into their respective work environments. That's really important. And so you can get a little of that through Zoom and, you know, online. I was just got off a meeting with some of the past Tradewell fellows, and we were all talking about how we're working with clients in our architecture firms and how are we drawing in live time on screen? Can multiple people draw together? So I think we do have some digital tools and we'll develop other ways, but I wonder a lot about retrofitting our existing spaces to be able to physically go in and maybe not necessarily be able to sit at the same table 2 or 3 feet away from each other, but can we still maybe be in closer proximity and utilize technology to interact? I think, you know, just like in medicine, one physician cannot treat a patient. You need an entire team. Same thing in architecture. So I think this is going to be a challenge going forward for schools, for offices, for hospitals, for almost every space, for public spaces.
Right. Because, I mean, I definitely think about the fact that I feel like going onto video chat is a very intentional thing. And so if you were, you know, you lose the kind of like bump into somebody in the hallway and then have this amazing conversation that leads to an insight that leads to something else. So I think, I mean, that's the one part that I'm kind of slightly mourning a little bit. I hope, you know, I don't want to see it be socially distanced forever.
Yeah, I'd like to think that this is time limited and that, you know, at some point we'll get back to sort of the way things were before. I'm not sure it's sustainable to think of humanity surviving with social distancing forever. But certainly I think design and design thinking and architecture can be helpful in developing solutions. And that, you know, that's one thing I think, you know, I think architects and designers injecting themselves into all different facets of public health is important. So thinking about retrofitting schools or public spaces, I think architects, designers, urban planners, urban designers, we're trained to think in those different dimensions and come up with, you know, even radical solutions if we want to. Right. So I think how can we make use of these people and their skill set is important, and to make sure we don't leave them out. I think architects have a lot to offer.
Speaking of collaboration, let's quickly talk about Clinicians for Design. It is an organization you co-founded, but can you tell us a little bit about it and its mission?
Sure. So it was really born out of this idea that, you know, multiple emails per week and calls from lots of different clinicians telling me about their design or their experiences related to design. I mentioned the surgeon who sort of said, you know, I could operate better. Someone called once and asked me about academic medical centers and said, I've noticed, you know, medical education has changed. Have buildings changed alongside it? I sort of thought, that's a really interesting question. I don't know that I know. So it was really meant to be an organization to bring like-minded professionals together who want to push forward the patient experience and healthcare interface. And specifically for clinicians, I think we have a lot of organizations that focus on healthcare design, but I didn't found we had we have lots of groups that bring clinicians together. Because every clinician I've ever met has some story about the design or architecture they've been forced to work in. And so making it a space where people can talk about it, develop seminars, a paper is really making it educational and trying to spread the word has been what we've been trying to do with Clinicians for Design. And so I think, you know, if we're going to start integrating design and medicine together, it can't just happen at the professional level as sort of a hobby on the side. I think it has to be integrated into the education phase, both in the design education and clinical education. And we do see some medical schools even offering elective courses in design thinking, right? And that's been a big change. But then that has to carry over into both the professional working side, professional architects and clinicians, and then also the research side. So I think it has to be multifaceted and multidimensional to really make a big change.
And then going beyond design thinking, thinking about an idea or scheming about an idea is one thing, but how do you get your ideas off the ground? How do you execute?
So I think it depends on the idea. Like all of us, I think, have lots and lots of ideas, and you know, a lot of them get filtered, and maybe one out of a bunch sort of makes it to a paper or a design change or a discussion in a professional forum. So lots of ideas. I think trying to focus on which one you can bring to fruition is important. I think the ones that really resonate with me emotionally, I think I tend to try to stick with. So for instance, I wrote a paper on the ethics of hospital design. I called it Bricks and Morals, right? That hospital buildings should do no harm. And that was based off a patient once telling me, as we took him out of our ICU that had no windows. Okay, there are ICU rooms with no windows, especially in New York. And he just, you know, started to cry and just say, he reached for me and said, you know, every prisoner has a window. Why can't every patient have one too? And I hear that line, and that was the opening line to the article. And I think that one statement just was really inspiring, and I knew that had to lead somewhere. And so, you know, learning bioethics and trying to infuse that into design is something I'm really passionate about now. And sort of, I almost think it's about taking different ideas, taking what that patient said, taking the fellowship experience in bioethics, blending a whole bunch of different things is the way you get somewhere, I would hope. And I often wonder, by writing a lot of these perspective pieces, you know, does it really create change? And I sort of struggle with that. I wonder, does it need to be an RCT, a randomized controlled trial, with a definite result? Is it enough just to write your thoughts and inspire someone else to think? And I think it is. You know, I think there's lots of ways to create change. And a story I tell often too is a patient in this windowless ICU, a different patient but same ICU, who was delirious, and we actually moved her to a window bed, and overnight she improved clinically. And the medical team actually took the data seriously on windows in ICUs, and we moved her. And although we don't know what actually caused the change, and it potentially wasn't the window, it caused the medical team to think about the physical space in their care plan. And when I talked about it with an architectural mentor, you know, he sort of said, it's okay that it wasn't a rigorous study, and it's an N of one, and it's anecdotal. You know, it's really meant to just spark change and spark ideas. And so I would encourage, you know, anyone out there to just, you know, just be aware, like think about what patients are telling you, be aware of your space. As architects, we're always looking up at the ceiling, counting ceiling tiles, checking square footages, looking at how things are laid out. So I'd say, you know, be aware of the space you're in, try to think about how it affects your everyday activities, how you deliver patient care. And, you know, listening to patients is always, I think, very inspiring for all of us.
What are some of your future goals?
Future goals. Well, I think, you know, I've jumped back and forth between focusing a lot on medicine for certain years, architecture for others. I think my ultimate destination, I hope, is to really perfect, in a way, this hybrid model. So I would like to develop a career model whereby I could have some time in clinical care with patients, which is extremely important, but also a foot in research, and then also some consulting work in design projects. And I think that sort of third split is not very common. I think the clinician educator, clinician researcher model, whether it's 25-75, 90-10, whatever the split is already established. But I've had a lot of people say, well, this isn't, you know, to be a researcher, you have to have 75% of your time in research. So I'm going to try it, and that's sort of the ultimate goal, because I think, to me, it's important to deliver clinical care, but also to try to answer some of these questions that keep burning in my mind. You know, what floor pattern is the right one for patients with dementia? There are certain floor patterns prevent them from walking. And we do know that there are certain patterns, depending on what the brain process is, that make patients not want to advance their gait. But we haven't really shown that. So a lot of burning questions to study. But then also, how do we apply that in projects? I don't feel it's enough to write about it necessarily in the clinical context. I want to be able to be at the table with the administrators and the clinicians and say, we got to do this design change to yield this product. So that's really the ultimate goal.
What are some of your favorite buildings in the world? What are places people should go visit?
Well, the one that comes to mind right away, which is probably my favorite space, is the Salk Institute. So if you're ever in La Jolla in San Diego in California, I would say it's the most powerful space I've ever been in, not necessarily the building, but what the building frames. And that's an important concept too, right? Architecture is more than the four walls and the ceiling and the floor. That negative space, right, or what Louis Kahn framed in this beautiful San Diego cliff view of the ocean, and using the building to frame that, is such a profound, almost existential experience when you go there. It's very powerful. And it doesn't matter what time of day or what the weather is, it's equally moving when you go there. But thinking about this idea of architectural atmospheres is interesting, right? So this negative space, what creates that atmosphere? Is it the four walls? Is it the layout? But definitely the negative space is something important. So the Salk Institute, I'd have to say, is my most favorite space in the world. The Sydney Opera House is a close second, and I went to see it, but it's got a wonderful story behind it with the architect who essentially won a global competition based on a very nautical romantic ink sketch, whereas all the other teams submitted finalized drawings, and this sort of romanticized, very poetic view was selected. But a lot of trouble with the construction, as the story goes, a lot of trouble with those different curvatures at the time with technology. And the story goes that the architect woke up one night and said, I've got it. Like, I have the solution, even though the engineering teams were having trouble. And he said, instead of doing sort of random curves and trying to calculate the structural ability of each curve, why don't we take a sphere, like an orange, and if you cut it up into pieces, the pieces together are structurally sound. So if you break it up, they should be structurally sound. So that kind of concept is very simplified. But I just love the fact that the architect had this like just wonderful sort of poetic notion, and it came to fruition through a design. And that's a very beautiful place to go, obviously, and definitely worth seeing if you can get over to Australia.
Awesome. Yeah. And then any healthcare buildings that you are particularly fond of?
Well, definitely the Paimio Sanatorium in Finland that inspired my career. I'd love to go back one day and see that. You can read about it on the internet. It's a World Heritage Site. Obviously very impactful, beautiful, and inspiring. The architect, Alvar Aalto, for that one, even designed all of the furniture. And, you know, he knew that this was a lung disease. He knew that sputum was produced. He went so far as to say, well, I'll put a sink in each patient room, but I'll also put a little basin for sputum, because I don't think people should spit into the sink where they're washing their hands. Or the wardrobe should go all the way to the floor for easier cleaning. Lots of different, you know, the Paimio chair is famous, sort of made out of bent plywood, where the architect felt he had calculated the exact angle of the chair so that patients could breathe the easiest if their lungs were filled with sputum. And that's amazing, you know, and I think that really shows the traditional architecture model of the master builder who designs every part of the space, even the interior design. And that's something I think that we should all be aware of with hospital design, even going beyond just the structure, but designing the contents of the space would be great too. So that's a wonderful space if anyone can go see it. I'd love to go see the Dementia Village. I have not seen it in person, but that's on my list. Awesome. To do.
And final question, where can people find you?
So like you said, I have a website, which hopefully you can make the link available, but it's docitect.com. Docitect is D-O-C-H-I-T-E-C-T. And then I'm also on Twitter a lot at Docitect. And, you know, there's an email through the website, but I'd encourage anyone to send an email. I form some great collaborations by people just reaching out and showing an interest in design and figuring out ways we can collaborate.
Awesome. Yeah, all the links will be in the show notes for everything we talked about. Thank you very much. This was really fun.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
The great innovator and businessman Steve Jobs once said, "Design is not just what it looks like and feels like. Design is how it works." As physicians, we're often subject to outside forces that impose the rules of where and how we work. But as Dr. Anderson shows, being a hybrid physician allows you to stretch your influence and design a career that works for you instead. So if you're thinking about picking up a second talent, skill, or superpower, why don't you give it a try and see how it works for you?
For more information about Dr. Hustle, to view today's show notes, or to contact Bassam, visit drhustle.com. If you want others to know about this podcast, please write a review at the podcast store, and please link to us on social media at dr_hustle on Twitter and at dr.hustle on Instagram. This podcast is produced by Bassam Zahid, whose other work can be found at bassamzahid.com. Thanks for listening.